Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. This week, we're visiting the 31st Annual Camden Conference, which aims to explore the state of foreign affairs amid shifts in global powers and the role of the U.S. in the changing world. Today, we'll hear two talks about this year's Camden Conference theme, New World Disorder and America's Future. First, Gerald Seib. He's a columnist and former Washington bureau chief at the Wall Street Journal. His talk is about nationalism and populism in the U.S. and their impact on American foreign policy. In the second part of the program, we'll hear from Chaz Freeman on the passing role of America as a world leader. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it'll be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to hear the program again at any time, as well as other archived Speaking in Maine programs. You can also find the program as a podcast. And now, Gerald Seib takes the stage.
Morning. Thank you. It used to be when you tell people that you worked in Washington, they'd say, oh, that must be interesting, or they'd say, wow, you're lucky. Nowadays, they're more likely to say, oh, I'm sorry. And people ask me whether things are different in Washington now, and I can only answer, the only thing that's different is everything. But you kind of already knew that, I think. The thing that's different that's relevant for our conversation today is simply this. We have arrived at a period of ascendant populism, personified, of course, by President Trump himself, who's probably the world's leading populist right now. Now, I know it may seem strange to call a billionaire businessman who built his empire in no small part by playing the financial and political establishment of New York to his benefit a populist, but that's what he is. And even if you don't buy that he's personally a populist, certainly many of his followers are. And that leads to the question that's on the table before us today that I'm going to try to address, which is, how does this rise of populism affect American foreign policy? So in response to that question, let me give my own thoughts first, gleaned mostly from watching the foreign trade and national security policies of the Trump administration emerge and evolve. And let me state my bottom line conclusion first, and then I'll back up to show how I reach it. I think the populism trend clearly affects international economic policy, and it somewhat affects other foreign policies. But I actually think it does very little to determine national security policies and postures or to help us predict attitudes about American involvement and intervention around the world. And in fact, some of the results so far are the opposite of what people expected. So let's start at the beginning and try to agree on terms. A lot of words get thrown around loosely today, and populist is certainly one of them. People apply it to all sorts of movements and tendencies. But let's go back to the basics. Populism isn't really an ideology at all. It's more an attitude. As somebody wrote in the American Interest magazine recently, populism is a means of doing politics, not an ideology. And generally, political scientists define populists as those who target a country's elites in the name of the people. Populists think the interests of the people, broadly speaking, are no longer represented by the elites in their society. Therefore, they question the legitimacy of the institutions that make up liberal democracies. And certainly by that definition, Donald Trump is, in fact, a populist, despite his wealth and despite his long experience using that system to his own advantage. And if you wanted the first clear sign that Donald Trump would be a different kind and a populist president, it arrived with the very first question in the very first presidential debate of the 2016 cycle, when all the assembled Republican candidates were asked whether any among them would decline to pledge that they would support the eventual Republican nominee, and Donald Trump alone raised his hand. He was saying that the very party in which he was running wasn't a legitimate institution to pick a presidential nominee. And if you think this rise of populism was restricted to Donald Trump and his followers, remember that the Democrats had their own populist candidate, Bernie Sanders, who in the primary season was nearly victorious, and that was almost as remarkable as Donald Trump's actual victory. Bernie Sanders wasn't and isn't an actual Democrat, so his candidacy amounted to an assault from the outside on the very institution of the Democratic Party, you know, the people who run it, and above all, the people who finance it. And you can't get much more populist than that. So if the textbook definition of a populist is someone who mistrusts the prevailing institutions and the elites who run them, then definitely that's a feeling on the rise in the U.S. And to state something that everybody in this room understands already, it's not a movement limited to the United States, and Matthew is going to talk about this a lot more knowingly than I can in just a few minutes, but the Brexit vote in the UK was a classic example. Populist voters mistrusting a long-accepted institution, the EU, and the elites who championed that institution. You know, I talked just after the Brexit vote to somebody who worked for Prime Minister David Cameron in the campaign, and he told me the government marshaled what he thought were a whole lot of really great economic arguments in favor of staying in the EU. And they were all pretty much useless because they were disbelieved, not because they were wrong, but precisely because they came from the government that people didn't trust anymore. That was enough to render them unbelievable on their face, to Brexit voters at least. So you see similar populist movements now in Hungary as well, and in France, and in Poland, where the movement is so strong that even Lech Walesa, who a generation ago was the ultimate anti-establishment figure, is so identified as part of today's elites that his former party and his former right-hand man running that party are essentially trying to erase him from the history books of Poland. So the obvious question is, why all this now? Why this populism in today's world? Well, certainly it's not unusual for political leaders of all varieties to cast aspersions on those who came before them. As somebody once said, the only American president who didn't blame everything on his predecessor was George Washington. So that part of this is completely normal. But it goes, you know, goes well beyond that. Populism is an attitude that says not just that the previous leaders were wrong, but that the very institutions that brought them to power were harmful to the people. And certainly one factor that opened the way to this feeling was the end of the Cold War. I mean, the institutions of Western democracies were easier to view as essential when they were being challenged by a rival ideological power armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons. The elites knew more than the average man or woman about holding the Soviet bear at bay, or so it was thought. So they had to be given wide berth to do exactly that. Obviously, that was an attitude that's now disappeared. But a far bigger reason, I think, for the rise of populism is the aftermath of the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. Now, real people felt real pain, and they believed the pain was inflicted upon them, that it was not inevitable, and that it was either the mistakes or the greed of the elites that produced that pain. In the U.S., a couple of big financial institutions failed, but otherwise the government bailed everybody else out. Nobody went to jail, and meanwhile, tens of thousands of Americans lost their homes in the process. Meanwhile, in Europe, the new integrated economic zone didn't shield countries such as Italy and Spain and their citizens from feeling huge shockwaves because of the recession. In a new book that's due to come out in a few weeks, William Galston, a political scientist at the Brookings Institution, and somebody I consider one of the smartest people in Washington, looks at the effect this has had. And the book is entitled Anti-Pluralism, the Populist Threat to Liberal Democracy. And in this book, Bill traces how populism began to rise after the Great Recession. Here's a quote from him. He says, "From Middle Europa to England's Midlands to the American Midwest, a revolt developed against the arrangements that have shaped the democratic West since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union. A populist surge threatened the assumptions and achievements of mainstream politicians and policymakers from the center-left to the center-right. Economic policies based on free trade and flexible labor markets came under attack. Cultural norms celebrating diversity and promoting immigration lost traction. International agreements and institutions yielded ground to nationalist forces." End of quote. So if that's what populism is, and that helps explain its recent rise, what does it tell you about the policies that it produces? Well, here I think the question isn't as easy to answer as some people imagine. As noted earlier, populism itself isn't ideological. Bill Galston notes in his book that this populist wave has produced governments in Europe of the far left and the far right simultaneously. He writes that, in sum, the European project now confronts populists who challenge liberal democracy's capacity to satisfy rank and file citizens. And in the U.S., you can argue that the Trump movement is actually a radical centrist movement. And when I say radical centrist, I mean that Donald Trump is not an ideological figure. He doesn't have an ideology of the left or ideology of the right. He doesn't really have any ideology at all. He's in the center in that sense, but he is interested in smashing the norms and the institutions that preceded him. So as a result, I think this populism tells you less about actual policy trends than may seem likely. Now, certainly there's a populist impulse on immigration, for example, that we're seeing play out right now on the national stage. And to help illustrate this, I wanted to draw on some numbers that we have gathered over the months from the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, which I oversee. If you go up here and you look at, for example, the first the top category is trade, and look only at the far left column, core Trump Republican voters. Those are the people I'm paying attention to. These are people who are core Trump supporters. And if you look, for example, in our poll in April, we asked people whether free trade is good for America or bad for America. And 57% of Americans overall said trade is good for America. But as you'll see there, among core Trump voters, only 39% said free trade is good for the country. And 54% said trade is bad for the country. Similarly, if you go down to immigration, you see the same populist trend emerge. We asked Americans whether immigration helps or hurts the country more, and 60% of all Americans overall said that immigration helps. But only 28% of core Trump supporters said that it helps the country, and 61% said immigration hurts. Likewise, I think there's a decided populist view of action to prevent climate change, which you'll see there as well. I think populists tend to view action to counter climate change as an idea of the elites, forced on them, on the working class, by people who have the luxury to actually worry about such things. So when we asked about climate change in this April poll, 67% of all Americans said taking some action is necessary. But as you'll see here, just 27% of core Trump supporters thought that was the case. So on these questions, trade, immigration, climate change, you see a clear populist impulse. But does that also mean what's commonly assumed, that this populism translates into isolationism and a desire to withdraw from the world more broadly? Well, here we find a different and a much more surprising answer: not necessarily. And you can see this in the category at the bottom here that says America's role in the world. In fact, in that April survey, our pollsters were somewhat stunned to find that there is something approaching an actual consensus across the two parties, and even among Trump supporters and everybody else, on America's role in the world. We asked whether America should be more or less actively involved in world affairs, and roughly half of Americans overall said more involved. And that included precisely half of core Trump supporters as well. It also included about half of Republicans, about half of Democrats, and just under half of independents. And in fact, Trump supporters were actually slightly more inclined than other Republicans to say America should be more involved in the world. And here you can see the consistency among Republicans, independents, and Democrats on the question of whether America should be more or less involved in the world. If you put it differently, America's role in the world actually is one of those rare issues these days where there's not a partisan and ideological divide and no obvious populist impulse. One of our pollsters called this a wow finding, because you don't see this on almost any issue these days. So our pollsters also tried to draw all these issues together and see whether they could find coalitions of globalists among Americans on one side and nationalists on the other. And globalists were defined for this purpose as people who believe trade is good, immigration is helpful, and they're in favor of a more active American role in the world. And nationalists were defined as believing trade is bad, immigration is harmful, and that they were in favor of a less active American role. And what we found is that the globalist coalition amounts to 22% of Americans, and the nationalist population coalition amounts to just 12% of Americans. So this means that on one important front, these are signs that the sentiments in actual Trump administration policies aren't necessarily going to be as isolationist as we think. Now, I decided to have a look at this question a little more deeply because I was asked to write a piece for a special section that we put out at the Journal for the opening of the Davos World Economic Forum at the beginning of the year. And the piece I was writing about was, in fact, about America's changing role in the world. And as part of that effort, I decided to dive into Pentagon data and to see whether some kind of withdrawal from America's security commitments could be seen in troop presence around the world, because after all, Donald Trump said in the campaign, America's doing too much work that ought to be left to our allies, and we should be paying more attention to what's happening at home and not be so involved in the world. What I found was that despite Donald Trump's complaints along these lines, that the U.S. was doing too much global security work that should be left to others. Actual Pentagon data show the deployment of American troops overseas has gone up rather than down over the last year. Troop levels abroad are up overall. They're, as you'll see here, they're up specifically and notably in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Kuwait, in Bahrain, and in other places. So in addition to that, the Trump administration was the first in years to deploy three carrier battle groups to the Pacific as part of the effort to warn North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to pull back from his nuclear and missile programs. And Mr. Trump also has, with some apparent reluctance, finally reiterated American support for Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization Charter. That's the one that commits the U.S. to defend its European allies if they're attacked. So why is this the case? Why is there a willingness to engage in the world to some extent amidst all this populism? Well, I think there's undoubtedly an impulse among some populists that says that only an activist U.S. abroad on the security front can protect them from outside forces and institutions they really don't trust. There is a fear of the outsider. There's also, therefore, a desire for the U.S. government to protect them from these outsiders. And that happens to be kind of the opposite of an isolationist tendency. So where does all that leave us? Well, maybe just confused, but maybe with something of a clearer picture than is commonly imagined about the effect of populism on national security policies. I do think populism produces an identifiable nativist tendency, keep the foreigners out impulse, and it definitely has an adverse impact on the views of the virtues of a global economy. Globalization is seen as a bad thing in terms of my own individual economic welfare and well-being. But it does not necessarily, at least, produce isolationist sentiments as commonly defined. And so bottom line, I think, is that like everything else in Donald Trump's Washington, in short, it's complicated and it's not exactly what it seems. Thank you all very much. I'm happy to have a few questions.
That was great. So, Jerry, I'm really interested in what you said about the populism being an ideology. And yet, even so, your figures show that it's not as much of an ideology, not as strong as Trump's victory and continued support would show. So take us forward with this thought. Given the numbers that you found in the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, does this mean that the support is eroding for the vision that Trump has for trade and, you know, populism in general? Or are there two different things here? Because I feel like some of it is an emotional thing.
Yeah.
Some of it is about the actual policy, but some of it is about emotion. And is there a way to pull those two apart so we can understand them better?
That's a really good question. You know, as I said, I think populism is an attitude, not an ideology. And I also think that it's cultural as much as economic in some ways. I think a lot of people voted for Donald Trump because they voted for his attitude, not his policies. I'm not sure they knew what his policies were, and to some extent those policies were actually harmful to their own personal economic self-interest in some ways. But I think the answer to your question of how does this play out in policy terms, I think we're just starting to find out the answer to that question, and particularly interesting on trade. You know, if you think about the Donald Trump rhetoric on trade in the campaign and the reality so far, the rhetoric spite is a lot worse than the reality so far. So, yes, he pulled out from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, the Pacific Trade Deal. But, you know, guess what? That was going to happen if Hillary Clinton won, too, because Congress had already basically gone south on TPP. So there is that. He said he'd tear up NAFTA. A year in, he has not torn up NAFTA. It's being renegotiated, not destroyed. He has basically said that we are going to impose trade sanctions on China, but that hasn't happened yet. He has promised to take trade actions against countries such as South Korea. That hasn't happened yet. He's much more interested in having a good relationship with South Korea in view of the North Korean threat than to actually start a trade war with them. So you have so far, you know, bite worse than bark. We'll find out. You know, the Commerce Department announced just yesterday that they're going to consider imposing tariffs or restrictions on aluminum and steel imports, and those are principally from Asia and China in particular, but they haven't done it yet, so we'll see. I think we are still in the process of figuring out how much populist policy there is in the Trump administration versus how much populist rhetoric from the president himself.
I think that the National Foreign Trade Council came out yesterday with a really strong comment against the aluminum and tin. Is that right?
Steel and aluminum.
Comment from the government, and I think that again brings us back to the point of Donald Trump has said very strongly things that are protectionist, that are sort of mercantilist, and even if it hasn't yet happened, what I'm not sure of is that because of incompetence that they can't get that done, or is it because it's all part of a grand strategy to sort of confuse the enemy or the adversary, not let them know what our bottom line is, and actually negotiate a better deal?
Well, one of the things I've learned is that most conspiracy theories fall apart on the altar of incompetence in Washington. So, so on this question, I guess I'm not inclined yet to see a grand strategy at work. I do think there has been an actual struggle within the Trump administration about exactly how protectionist to be, exactly how confrontational to be on trade policy. And I think one of the frustrations that President Trump has had sometimes, apparently including with Wilbur Ross, his Commerce Secretary, is that he wanted to go out and have more confrontation than the system was allowing him to do. And I think that's because reality sets in, right? I mean, at some point, people walk into your office, and this happened, I'm from Kansas originally, and shout out to Kansas, thank you. And so one of the things that happened is this: as this threat of actions against China, specifically on steel and aluminum imports, was playing out, the Chinese obviously figured out this was happening. And a little item appeared in the Chinese press a couple of weeks ago in which the Chinese said, you know, we're looking at the possibility that there is American sorghum being dumped in China, and we might have to do something about that. And sorghum prices immediately took the dive. And because people thought there was not going to be a market anymore for American sorghum overseas, the domestic market was going to be flooded, farmers panicked. So a group of Republican senators, including one from my home state of Kansas, immediately trekked over to the White House to have a meeting with President Trump and said, wait just a minute. You know, if you get into this trade war with China, you might help steel producers in Ohio, but you're going to hurt sorghum farmers in Kansas, and we don't really want that. And by the way, they're figuring out the same thing about markets in Latin America if NAFTA is undone. So, you know, this is a very complicated picture. It's a Rubik's Cube, and it's not as simple as the rhetoric suggests, and I think that's one of the discoveries that President Trump has made since he took office.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. We just heard Gerald Seib speak at the 31st Annual Camden Conference, discussing nationalism and populism in the U.S. You can hear his talk again anytime by visiting mainepublic.org.